He gets pissed off when I don't want to talk about things and shuts the session down like he's having a fucking tantrum.
What things are you talking about? I ask gently, and she frowns at me.
He's my therapist, Lexi. If I can't talk to him about it, why would I talk to you?
I'm startled and I pause before I shrug. I don't know. I just want to help, I guess.
You're doing enough. I can't keep relying on you to fix me every time I fuck up. If I'm going to be a good mom, I have to learn to face my problems myself.
And so, Luke is pressuring you to talk about things you don't want to talk about, but you know you need to if you're going to get on top of this. Is that what you're saying?
Tears fill her eyes and she shakes her head and admits in a whisper,
I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm so tired and so confused. I just know that I hate it here. And I should be with my baby.
I stay for almost 2 hours. I try to fill her in on the days of Daisy's life that she's missed, but it's difficult to keep the conversation positive when so many of those days have just been hard. I wish I had some tangible milestone to report that doesn't involve her morphine dosage. But Daisy isn't even smiling yet, so I can only talk about the improvement in her symptoms. When the time comes for me to leave, Annie cries some more and thanks me for coming.
Hang in there?
I ask her tentatively. She looks at me helplessly. Do I have a choice? 4 days later, I'm driving home from the hospital when my phone rings. It's the rehab clinic, and I answer it anxiously.
It's me,
Annie croaks down the line. I can tell immediately that she's been crying. I clutch the steering wheel harder until my knuckles turn white.
What happened?
How is Daisy?
I notice that she's deflected my question, but it must be a good sign if she's been granted access to the phone.
She's had a good day today, one of the best she's had yet.
I take a deep breath and ask again,
So, what's going on?
I can't stay here, Lexi.
I pull to the side of the road. My stomach lurches, and I think for a minute I'm going to be sick. I close my eyes and breathe carefully, purposefully, trying to calm myself. It's like I'm living a flashback to the last time this happened, and the time before that, and those earlier times I really thought that Annie completing rehab was the most important thing in the world. I couldn't even imagine back then how much higher the stakes could actually be.
Annie, I say, very slowly and very carefully, you have to stay. You have to complete the program. For Daisy, remember?
You don't understand, Lexi. They are picking on me. Luke is such an asshole, and no one here likes me, and it's just not working. The scar still hurts from her birth all of the time, and I can't forget even for a second of the day that I'm here and not with her where I belong.
Her voice increases in pitch and volume. I let her speak, waiting patiently for the rush of energy to fade. As I sit in my car by the side of the highway, my hand is pressed over my mouth to hold in the sobs. It is too hard to talk to her when she's like this. I know from experience that there is nothing I can say to calm her.
Would you just say something?
She exclaims eventually. I bite my lip and I admit in a hoarse whisper,
Annie, I don't know what to say.
You have to help me, Lexi. Get me out of here, for fuck's sake. Are you really going to leave me in here to rot like this while the early days of my baby's life slip away?
She hangs up then, and I open my eyes and stare at the screen on my dash. The call lasted less than a minute. I go home, and I ignore Sam's repeated insistence that I come to bed. Instead, I sit at the computer and I Google for hours, trying to figure out a way to keep her out of jail if she did walk out of the clinic. There's no guard at the gate to stop her, no one to save her from herself. Even as midnight passes, I'm still staring blindly at legislation that may as well be written in Greek, and I'm no closer to finding a loophole. And of course I'm not, because if a loophole existed, Bernie would have told me about it. I wake up at the desk in the office. My neck is stiff and my eyes are gritty. I pour several cups of black coffee down my throat and call Luke at 9 a.m. the next morning. What the hell is going on? She's obviously not handling the process well at all. Why haven't you called me?
Alexis, I have explained this to you. Your sister is here to get help and treatment. You don't need to be involved on a day-to-day level. If anything of significant concern happens, I will call you.
His nonchalant attitude is irritating, and I can suddenly see why Annie is finding this man's treatment so difficult to deal with. Last night, she was threatening to walk out of there, so I'd say that's a significant concern.
Annie is well aware that if she leaves the clinic, I have to call the police and they will arrest her. She won't risk that, Luke says calmly, and the easy modulation of his tone infuriates me more.
Maybe you're not the right person to treat Annie, I snap. She said you're making things very difficult for her, and you said yourself you rarely treat patients directly, maybe someone with more recent experience.
Don't you see what she's doing, Lexi?
Luke interrupts me, still speaking very gently.
Can you really not recognize when she's playing you against me?
I falter, my mouth still hanging open. I try to reframe this whole situation in my mind, to take myself out of the panic of her call and turn off my automatic reaction to the pleading in her voice. And then I can see, as clear as day, that once again Luke is absolutely correct. Shit, I whisper, and then I sigh. I'm sorry.
I'm asking her to walk me back over her history, and she's refusing to participate in the therapy. She's not engaging, and I don't believe she will make any progress at all until she starts to unpack the things in her life that have led her to this point. So yes, I'm pushing her, and yes, I'm asking a lot of her, but I'm doing it because she can't leave this place until she really makes herself vulnerable. Otherwise, she'll wind up right back where she started.
Okay. My face feels hot as the embarrassment of the moment dawns on me. I'm a doctor, for God's sake. I should have seen this myself. I'm really sorry.
Annie is a woman of incredible potential. She's articulate and intelligent. But that also makes her dangerous because she's just clever enough to know how to manipulate. And as I'm sure you're aware, addiction can make even the sincerest people expert manipulators. Listen, since we're chatting anyway, I'm trying to convince her to join in some of the group sessions to bring her out of her shell a little. Even just occupational therapy would be a good start. A lot of our patients like to do crafts or sports, but Annie's refused everything we've invited her to. Any ideas what might draw her out?
She loves to read and write. I mean, Annie was an English major. If there's a book club or a poetry group or something like that?
No, not really, Luke says, but I hear him shuffling papers. Interesting. When Annie was admitted and we asked her about her education, she just listed a GED.
No, she has an English degree. Her career kind of died in the mud when the addiction spun out of control, but she's quite a gifted writer, I say. I have no idea why she wouldn't list the degree on the paperwork.
I treated a neurologist once who had listed his occupation on admission as janitor, Luke says quietly. He'd been fired from his job and was embarrassed that his career had failed. Sometimes it's easier to pretend you've never achieved anything than to admit you've had success and failed.
I think I've got an idea, I say, and I walk up the stairs from the kitchen. I open the door to the spare bedroom down the hall from mine, a room that is used only for storage, and I stare inside. There are boxes everywhere, but only a few are labeled Annie. She has this journal our dad gave her just before he died. It was incredibly special to her. I don't think she's ever written in it. I still have it in storage here somewhere. Maybe I could bring it next weekend? If she doesn't want to talk to you, maybe she can write her feelings down instead. I'm due to visit Annie on Saturday, but Friday afternoon, Luke emails me to ask me not to come.
I've had to withdraw Annie's visitation and phone privileges. I know you'll be very concerned by this, but Annie has continued to refuse to participate in her treatments this week, and went as far as to refuse to leave her room for our appointment yesterday. I hope that you understand that I'm suggesting we put a pause on contact for both your sake and Annie's. I'm concerned that she would continue to try to draw you in to rescue her. But I've also been thinking about that journal you mentioned. Do you think you could mail it over to us?
Right beneath that email is one from Oliver. I groan and glance at the date. The 4 weeks leave he agreed to is up, and I haven't even called in to let him know I won't be back next week. I hesitate before I open the email. The subject line is only the word, leave. This can't be good. I click the screen on my phone fiercely.
Lexi, Sam tells me that you are immersed in things with the baby. I've changed your leave to adoptive leave, so that will give you another 2 months to figure things out. Come have a chat with me if you're ready before then. Otherwise, let me know what you're up to in the new year.
You called Oliver on my behalf? I greet Sam at the door that afternoon, a glass of wine in one hand, a scowl on my face. I left Daisy early and have been sitting at home stewing over the email ever since. Sam looks at me in surprise.
I know how stressed you are. I just wanted to lighten the load.
You didn't even ask me.
What was your plan, honey?
Sam asks me pointedly.
Your leave runs out on Monday. It's Friday, and you hadn't given it a thought until Oliver called you, right?
He didn't call me, I snap. I know I'm being an idiot, and his method of communication is completely irrelevant, but I'm too frustrated and angry to stop myself. He emailed me, and you had no right.
So, were you going back to work on Monday?
Sam drops his bag near the door and closes it, then shrugs at me, prompting an answer. You know I wasn't, I mutter.
And?
Sam, I exclaim, it's my career, my problem. I dropped the ball, yes, but...
And what was I supposed to do? Let you get fired?
I wouldn't have...
I saw Oliver last week, Lexi. He was pissed, but understood. If I hadn't gone in and you really had forgotten all about your job and just not showed up next week, he would have fired you.
I spin on my heel away from Sam, then storm into the kitchen to stir the spaghetti sauce I made. He follows me and sits at the island watching me huffing and puffing around. After a while, he stands and, ignoring my protests, takes the wooden spoon from my hand and turns me to face him.
I love you. I get that you have to deal with some of this on your own, but you can't deal with all of it on your own. You've rejected every offer of help I've made, and I knew that if I asked you if you wanted me to talk to him, you'd have said no. I need to be doing something, Lexi. You can't just shut me out because it's messy. This isn't a short-term crisis anymore. This is all going to be a part of our lives for months, maybe years.
But it's my problem, Sam, I whisper, and my bravado disappears. And my eyes fill with tears. Sam brushes the hair back from my face.
It's Annie's problem, Lexi, and she's my soon-to-be sister-in-law.
I nod, and Sam cups my face in his hands. He stares down at me, and I clench my jaw to stop the tears. I'm sorry, I whisper. It's just really hard for me to share these problems with you.
Why, Lexi?
Habit? Pride? Stubbornness?
Please let me help.
he says, and then he punctuates his sentences with kisses all over my face. Please let me support you. Please let me carry you. Please let me care for you. I'll try. I'll try harder. He presses his forehead against mine and draws in a slow breath. I'm sorry, I say again.
Okay.
Then he adds in a whisper,
so we're okay?
We're okay.
Good,
Sam says softly.
Then that's all that matters.
30. Annie. Luke, everything is darker from here. My story up until now has had shades of light, but we've reached the part where it starts to spiral. It was such an ordinary night. I'd finished the first draft of my manuscript and was working through refining it. I actually had the first few chapters ready to send off to my editor friend. I'd been procrastinating about sending them for weeks, though, and the longer I prolonged it, the more nervous I became about how it would be received. I was so worried about the email that I couldn't sleep, so I went out for a walk. Then I called my dealer and I bought a bag. I didn't see the police officer. I only realized he'd been watching the deal when he crash-tackled me as I turned to walk away. I was arrested for possession of a controlled substance. The judge granted bail, but there was no one in Chicago I could call to get me out except for my boss and colleagues, and there was no way I could call them. I sat in the cell for half the night before I finally found the courage to call Lexi. I told her some bullshit story about how it was all a mix-up, and I was scared work would find out and I'd lose my job. She called my boss first thing the next morning and told him I was really sick, and she got on a plane. She was in Chicago by lunchtime to post bail. In the cab on the way back to my apartment, she was silent, staring out the window, her expression completely blank. I kept glancing at her, waiting for her to say something. When we got to my apartment, I made us both coffees, and we sat at my little dining room table. The cop told me that you were buying heroin, Annie, she whispered. You said on the phone it was a mix-up. Can you explain that to me? I was buying weed, I lied, and I said it so convincingly that even I nearly believed it. I use it occasionally to de-stress when I'm busy at work. I think the dealer panicked when he saw the cop and he passed me the wrong bag. Such bad luck. Lexi thought about this for a while, and then she nodded. And the weed, are you using much? Hardly ever, Lex, I promise you, I said. Every now and again. But obviously after last night, that'll stop. Lexi went home that same day. She couldn't miss any more work. She made me promise to tell her my court date, but I didn't. Instead, I called her after it was over, and I pretended I'd forgotten she wanted to be there. I was actually lucky that time. I had been buying from the same dealer for years and trusted him, so I'd accepted the paper bag he'd offered me without checking the Ziploc bag inside. The cop had seen me give $100 to the dealer, which would have been quite a lot of weed, but the paper bag contained only a few grams of powder. The prosecution argued that if I really did just ask for weed, I must have known I wasn't getting what I asked for purely by the weight of the bag, but the judge felt they'd failed to prove my guilt beyond reasonable doubt. You and I both know what really went on that night, Ms. Vidler, he said to me as he delivered his verdict. But the prosecution has failed to prove their case efficiently, so I have no choice but to find you not guilty. Take this as a free pass from the universe and sort your life out, because there won't be a second one. My lawyer told me afterward that if the cop had seen me check the bag, it would have meant a felony and likely jail time, up to 4 years. That scared the shit out of me, and I stayed stone-cold sober for weeks. But I missed the rush. And I missed the high. I don't think I was physically addicted yet. There was no withdrawal. Instead, I missed it, like I missed Lexi, like I missed Mom, like I missed Dad. For better or worse, heroin was part of my family now. I was more careful when I bought it the next time. I found a new dealer, covered my tracks better, got a bit smarter about hiding it. But then I felt smart and superior. and more confident that I had been caught once and I knew how to stop it from happening again. And I still hadn't sent the chapters, but now I was starting to worry that I'd taken too long. So instead of sitting up worrying about whether the editor was going to like what I'd written, I sat up and worried that I'd missed my one shot to make it. I started using a little more regularly, every week instead of every second week, then every few days, and then it snowballed. The more I used it, the less sick I felt after, but the harder it was to hit the rush, so I was using more and more. Soon, I was bumping the minute I walked in the door from work. And then the day came when I couldn't get myself out the door without a hit. And then I was sneaking my kit into my bag so I could bump at lunchtime just to get through the day. And then, I couldn't afford to pay my rent and to buy enough smack to last me the whole week. And so I started selling off things in my apartment. First, it was the meager jewelry I'd amassed, then furniture. Soon, my apartment contained only my computer, stacks of books, and a mattress. I got a warning at work for missing days I hadn't even realized I'd missed. And then one of my colleagues caught me shooting in the disabled toilet, and I lost my job.
31. Lexi. Daisy's pediatrician tells me that she's probably going to be ready for discharge in a few days. This is great news, but it's also terrifying news. 40 days have passed since the birth. 40 days that I have not worked, I've barely kept up with my laundry, and cleaning the house has become a distant memory. 40 days over which Sam has gradually become a stranger I pass in the hallway and share lunch with every now and again. 40 days, and my life has shifted from predictable and organized and functional to chaos that I cannot seem to unscramble. I have bonded deeply with Daisy, of course I have. She is tiny and fragile, and she's been in pain for so much of that time. I've wept for her almost as much over this month as I have wept for Annie in the last decade. But now she's coming into my home. No longer can I just clock out and leave the responsibility behind with nurses overnight. No, once Daisy is discharged, it is entirely up to me to keep her safe and well. And I have to get it right. I can't afford to take a wrong step. Daisy has already been through hell, and there's more to come. If Annie gets herself together in rehab somehow, and we can convince CPS she's up to the task of parenting Daisy, then Daisy will go home with her mother eventually. But where is home? Is it in my house, further extending the chaos? Or is it in the trailer? I don't even know who owns that trailer or how Annie paid the rent, if she has at all. And what if Annie doesn't make it through rehab, as seems increasingly likely? I don't have a clue what I'd do then, and I can't bear to think about it. Mary Rafferty calls and asks if she and Bill Weston can visit the house. There are some formalities we need to attend to before Daisy formally comes into your care, she says. Bill and I could come by this evening, maybe after your fiancé finishes at the hospital. I fumble to think of a reason to decline or at least postpone her request. Of course you can, but... I trail off, thinking of the dishes in the sink and the piles of laundry waiting for our attention. Then I think of the room where Daisy will sleep, which is full of boxes, some of which I've torn open and tipped onto the floor when I was looking for Annie's diary. I know you've been busy with the baby at the hospital, Dr. Vidler. I won't be expecting a clean house if that's what you're worried about, Mary says gently. It's just, we haven't even got the nursery in order yet, I say hesitantly. We'll do it on the weekend, but... Oh, that's not what I'm looking for either. It's a safety check, a procedural thing, you understand? There's a checklist I need to follow. I mainly need to see that Daisy is going to a home where she will be safe. And if there's a thing or two that still needs doing before she comes home, it's no big deal, truly. I agree to meet Mary and Bill at our place just after 5 p.m., and then I sprint to my car and call Sam as I drive home. I spend the afternoon frantically cleaning and trying to restore some order to the house.
I hide baskets of laundry and scrub the kitchen, focusing so hard my vision almost tunnels. I spend 10 minutes trying to polish out a tiny stain on the countertop that was there when we bought the house, and when I can't lift it, I sob. When Sam comes home, he finds me in the immaculate bathroom trying to hide my blotchy skin with makeup. He says, looking at me with visible panic. What happened? There's a stain on the countertop, I say, and I burst into tears again. What if they say we can't have her? What if they want to send her to some foster carer who has clean countertops? Sam looks at me blankly. Can't we just cover the stain with the fruit bowl? But by the time we open the front door, the house is sparkling clean, and Sam and I are both wearing our brightest smiles. It's so lovely to see you again, Dr. Vidla, Mary greets me with a beam. You too, I say politely, and I step aside to allow them to enter the hallway. Sam leads the way around our house, giving a laid-back tour, mentioning the layout and the renovations as we walk. Mary scrawls notes, and I twist my neck this way and that, trying unsuccessfully to read what she's written. We finish at the room we're planning to set up for Daisy, right across the hall from ours. It's been our storage room, Sam says wryly. We're going shopping for baby things on the weekend. I hastily glance at Mary and Bill, but neither seems bothered by our lack of preparation. Mary catches my eye and offers me a quiet smile. Can we take a seat downstairs and have a little chat? My knees are stiff as we walk down to the living room. Bill and Mary sit on the sofa opposite Sam and me, and Sam takes my hand, then glances at me. He must correctly read in my face how terrified I am, because he releases my hand and instead slides his arm around my shoulders. The house is fine. There are just a few specifics we need to discuss, Bill murmurs. Then he glances at Mary, and at her nod, he turns back to Sam and me. Firstly, I'd like to hear whether either of you has any experience with young children, particularly newborns. He stops mid-sentence, then cringes. Wait, that's a bit of a silly question. Sorry, I don't usually conduct these interviews with doctors. Sam laughs quietly. Yes, we're both well-versed in the needs of caring for a newborn baby. Of course, my apologies. Perhaps you can tell me about your support networks? Bill asks next. We have a good network of friends around Montgomery, I say, plus colleagues from our workplaces, and the neighbors are all good people, too. Do you have people you could call on if you needed emotional or practical support? Or say if there was an emergency with Daisy and you weren't sure what to do? Sam and I exchange a glance. I'm finally starting to relax, because if this is the standard we need to meet, we really are going to be fine. Again, we're both doctors, but if a situation were to arise where we needed more expert help, I play golf with Daisy's pediatrician on weekends, so I guess we'd just call him. Mary laughs softly. We have a set of questions we generally ask in these circumstances. It's a good problem to have that most of those questions seem a bit absurd in your situation. Trust me. Bill nods, but then he fixes his gaze right on me, and he says quietly, I did a background check on you, Alexis. All was in order, of course, but I was surprised by how high your debt burden is. You've still got student loans and several large credit cards. It's an unusually extensive debt, even for someone who's been through med school, isn't it? This catches me off guard, and I'm instantly defensive again. Annie was in my care from the time she was 14, Bill, so I didn't exactly have a lot of time for saving a nest egg to cover my tuition, I say. And Sam very gently contracts his arm along my shoulders. I take a deep breath. Yes, there was undergrad tuition, and then med school tuition. But then Annie needed to go to rehab, and she didn't have insurance, so I borrowed for that, too.
I've been paying it down as quickly as I can, but you're right. My finances could be healthier. I'm working on it, but it's under control. Bill and Mary don't need to know this, but when we first tried to buy the house, the mortgage was declined because of my outstanding debt. Sam cashed in some stocks, so we had a larger deposit, and that got us over the line. But at one stage, we thought we were going to have to get the mortgage in his name only.
Well, yes. But then now there's also the mortgage on this house. And of course you'll be responsible for both Annie's and Daisy's hospital care bills and the rehab facility fee. Are you sure you can afford to take another 8 weeks off?
Bill asks. He's still pleasant, but I can't help but feel like we're finally moving into a make-or-break discussion, and now my anxiety about this meeting seems justified.
You did a background check on me, too, right?
Sam asks. Bill nods, and Sam continues calmly.
So you know that the only debt I have is the mortgage on this house, and I do have reasonable assets. So you'll be supporting Alexis and Daisy financially, then?
Bill asks.
No,
Sam says abruptly. I'm not supporting them like they're some kind of burden. Lexi and I are a team. She doesn't have a backlog of debt to cover. We do.
And when you split it between the two of us and our collective salaries now, it's entirely manageable. And regarding the medical bills, we'll get a substantial staff and family discount off what's left after Medicaid. As Lexi said, it's all under control.
Okay?
I wasn't accusing you two of poor financial management,
Bill says quietly.
I just need to be absolutely sure that I know what the care arrangement for the baby is going to be until Annie is cleared to resume responsibility for her. I would hate to approve this kinship care and then find in a few weeks that Alexis has returned to work full-time and you're leaving Daisy with a nanny or at a daycare.
That's not going to happen. I frown at him. Although I don't see why it would be a problem if I did. Are you saying working mothers can't be foster parents?
Well, obviously, a better situation is to have an infant with a stay-at-home carer as much as possible. And in this case, Daisy's NAS is a complication that needs very careful attention. I'd much rather see Daisy at home with you full-time, at least for now. And we've just assured you she will be.
Sam says, we've talked a lot today about this period while Annie is at rehab, Mary says, changing the subject. Have you two discussed what happens afterward? Or if, heaven forbid, Annie doesn't complete the program? Sam and I exchange a glance. We haven't discussed this, partly because when Sam has tried to broach it, I've changed the subject. It's too frightening. And I have too much to deal with day to day to risk a conversation that might not go well. I just don't know how he would feel about us taking permanent care of my sister's kid, and I'm too scared to find out. I'm not even sure how I feel about it. My thoughts on the possibility of longer-term care for Daisy change all the time. Some days I'm resigned to its inevitability, and perhaps that's why I'm too afraid to discuss it with Sam. On those days, all that matters is that the gentle love I had for Daisy has grown into something extraordinary and powerful. That devotion is already becoming a force to be reckoned with. My beautiful, innocent niece is relying on me, and I'll do whatever it takes to ensure she has a stable upbringing. And occasionally, I have fleeting moments of clarity when I know somehow that I'll be raising Daisy, and I'm petrified of what that means for Sam and me. He's not accustomed to a family that throws curveballs like this. Longer-term care of Daisy may mean assuming responsibility for Daisy while Annie pops in and out of our lives, probably bringing drama with every new encounter. What if Sam decides it's just too much? What do I do then? I don't know. I won't let my niece or my sister down, but Sam is the best thing that ever happened to me. What if he asked me to choose? I couldn't, and I can't even begin to process how I might. and so I don't let myself go there. Besides which, sometimes I genuinely believe that Annie is going to be fine. All she has to do is stay at rehab, then I can help her set up and resume responsibility for her daughter. When I frame this situation like that in my mind, I can convince myself that I don't even need to talk to Sam about a longer-term future with Daisy, because everything is going to be just fine. And as for right now, I'm exactly on the fence. Longer-term care of Daisy might be required, but equally it might not. And Sam and I haven't discussed it, so I can't really give Mary a definitive answer. We would have to really give that some thought if it happened, I tell her quietly.
Are you saying you wouldn't consider longer-term care of Daisy?
Bill seems to latch on to this, and his gaze narrows a little.
No, that's not what we're saying, Sam murmurs. We're saying we haven't talked about it. I think it would be wise if you did.
Bill starts to pack up his paperwork. What's that supposed to mean? I can't help it. I'm defensive of Annie. I might doubt her ability to overcome these challenges with every second heartbeat, but I can't bear the thought of someone else doing it.
Dr. Vidler, I'm praying that in 8 weeks' time I'm getting ready to tell the judge that Annie is clean. She has somewhere suitable to live and the means to support herself. Mary pauses, then nods toward Bill. We would love nothing more than to be able to recommend to Judge Brown that the responsibilities for Daisy's care be transferred back to her mother.
There's a but hanging in the air. I hold my breath as I wait for it, and I'm fighting the urge to put my hands over my ears like a toddler and shout, "Don't say it! Don't say it! Don't say it!" Mary's gaze becomes almost pleading. She offers me a very sad smile, and she murmurs,
"But I think you and I both know that's an unlikely prospect at best, given Annie's history."
Annie is going to beat this, I say stiffly.
I really do hope that you're right about that.
Bill sighs.
It's curious, isn't it, how one family can produce someone like yourself and someone like your sister. It really makes you wonder sometimes.
The way Bill's lip curls whenever he refers to Annie sets my teeth on edge. I rise abruptly and say, "Is that all?" I show Mary and Bill to the door, and we shake hands and exchange farewells with an artificial level of politeness. Once I close the door behind them, Sam and I stare at one another.
"Did that go well?"
he asks, his face set in a confused frown.
"I thought it did, but there were some moments there."
I keep seeing Bill's curled lip in my mind, and my anger simmers. "They don't know her," I mutter. "How dare they presume to know her?" I run my hand through my hair and exhale. I need a glass of wine or a bath, maybe a walk to clear my mind. Sam is standing in the center of the hallway, almost blocking my way back to the living area, and when I take a step, he doesn't move. I frown at him.
"Lex," he says cautiously, "we really do need to talk about what happens if..."
"Don't you do it too!" I cut him off sharply, and Sam falls silent, but still he doesn't shift out of my way.
"You keep postponing this discussion, Lexi, and I don't know what that means. Can't we just talk about it?"
"Just talking about it is a betrayal of Annie," I say flatly. "If I don't believe in her, who will? So no. I don't want to just talk about it, because I want to focus my energies on believing that she can do this."
"But do you?"
Sam says, and I scowl at him. "Do I what?
Do you believe that she can do this?"
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Perhaps if I were a braver person, I'd be vulnerable with Sam right now and admit my doubts. I really could do with a good soul-fortifying cry in his arms.
I could admit to him how scared I am, that tossing Annie out of my life 2 years ago was a colossal mistake that we can't come back from. I could confess to him how out of control my life feels right now, and how crazy that makes me feel. I could give voice to the way that the thought that I might not be able to help Annie shakes me to the very core of who I understand myself to be, and how frightened I am that I'll overcompensate for all of that turmoil and doubt by clinging to Daisy too tightly and make an even bigger mess. I could tell Sam that I'm a fixer, that I'm the fixer in my family. I was the girl who could hold things together when they began to crumble. I was the girl who could, overnight, become an adult if it meant keeping my family together. I'm the woman who stops at nothing to restore order when it's lost, not just in my life, but in my sister's life. That is who I am, in a way that's somehow truer than any other aspect of my identity. And that's why my failure to help Annie makes me question every single thing I know about myself. Her addiction has been a swirling abyss of risk in my life for 6 years now. If she succumbs to it, then somehow I'm lost to it too. Because since Dad died, she and I have been linked in a way that I can't separate or even fully understand. But I'm not brave enough to give voice to any of that yet. And so instead of my vulnerability, Sam gets my defense mechanisms. "How can you even ask me that?" I snap. He makes a sound that's half groan, half sigh, and I push past him. I walk by the sofas and toward the stairs, and his pleading voice follows me, an open invitation to stop right now before I use the mess of my relationship with Annie to cause damage to my relationship with him. "Honey, please don't shut me out. I'm going for a walk," I say abruptly over my shoulder. "I just need some time to myself." I pull on workout clothes and I fix all of my thoughts on the cool air waiting outside. I'll walk around the block a few times. I'll soak up the atmosphere of our comfortable, affluent neighborhood in the early evening until I can believe again that I belong here. I look through windows into the lamp-lit glow of the homes of normal families all around us, and I'll tell myself that everything is going to be okay for Sam and me, too, eventually. But when I come back downstairs, he is waiting for me at the front door. His arms are crossed over his chest, and his jaw is set. And when I look into his eyes, I see not anger, but determination. "Well?" I say. And he opens his arms and turns his palms upward, as if he's surrendering. I look at his hands. Strong hands, hands that hold life every single day. They are trustworthy and capable hands, and they belong to a man who shares those qualities. A man who does not deserve to be shut out. I just wish that I knew how to let him in. "I'll drop it for now, okay? We don't even have to talk." "I told you I need a walk," I say. And when Sam doesn't react, I add pointedly, "By myself." "And I don't want you walking around out there on your own in the dark, so I'll forget about the conversation you obviously aren't ready to have. But please, let me walk with you, okay?" It's my turn for a frustrated sigh, but I let him follow me around as I stomp my way through the neighborhood. When we finally walk back through the door 45 minutes later, Sam speaks for the first time since we left. "I think I'll cook pasta for dinner tonight. Does that sound okay?" "Yes," I say softly. "That sounds good. Thanks." "We haven't watched a movie together in a while. Let's open a bottle of wine and try to relax tonight, huh?" He's already on his way to the kitchen when I catch his hand. Sam turns back to me, eyebrows raised. "Thanks," I say, a little reluctantly. Because although I'm grateful for his patient support, I want to make sure that he understands that word is not an open invitation to resume a more in-depth discussion. Sam nods, then twists his wrist around and slides it back, so that he can take my hand and pull me toward himself. Once I'm stiffly pressed against his chest, he wraps his arms around my body and just holds me. We stand in silence for a moment. Then Sam kisses the side of my head and murmurs, "I love you, Lexi." The terse walk didn't relax me much, but somehow that hug and those words reground me. I inhale deeply, and when I exhale, I feel the knotted muscles of my shoulders start to give, and I melt against him a little. "I love you, too," I whisper back. "Tonight," Sam tells me, "we relax together, okay?" "Okay." The next morning, Bill calls Sam to let him know that we've been appointed as Daisy's legal guardian at his recommendation, with a review planned for the week before Annie is due to graduate from rehab. "Why did he call you?" I frown when Sam tells me the good news.
"Doesn't matter?"
"No," I sigh, "not really."
"Have they given you a more definitive timeline for Daisy's discharge?"
"Last I heard, they were thinking it would be toward the end of next week."
"We better get some diapers this weekend, then."
"I think diapers are the least of our worries. We better get some sleep." I'm caught off guard that afternoon when the pediatrician announces that they're going to drop Daisy's last few mLs of morphine quicker than they'd planned. Her NAS scores have been stable enough to complete the final part of the weaning process.
"So, when do you think she'll be discharged?" I ask hesitantly.
"Well, if she's stable on this dose today, we'll try her without anything for tomorrow. I'd like to observe her for a day, maybe two, but then we can discharge her."
I head straight to the store to look at supplies. I intend to just browse and return with Sam on the weekend, as we have planned. But while I'm there, I decide that I'll go ahead and buy the things that we need. I'm so overwhelmed by the options that I find myself just nodding mutely as the clerk throws products at me. I get a change table with a built-in bath, and the most expensive cot and organic sheet sets, and the best diapers, and I know that Daisy is quite dependent on her pacifier, so I buy a number of those. And then I buy the premium formula in bulk, and I buy bottles and toys that she won't use for months or years. I tell myself Daisy can use the toys even after she goes home with Annie, and that succumbing to the appeal of a stuffed teddy bear or a set of stacking cups is definitely not a sign that I'm expecting Daisy to stay long term. It is only as I get into my car that I realize how much money I have just wasted. I don't need the formula, for a start. I have no idea what I was thinking. Maybe I wasn't. Daisy has some gastro difficulties, which is typical for children with NAS, so she'll stay on prescription formula for months. I console myself that Annie will take the store formula and use it later on, when Daisy is older. And as I leave the store, depleted savings account aside, I now feel more prepared for Daisy's arrival. When I get home, Sam's car is in the driveway. I reverse into the garage and he opens the internal door and stares at the overloaded car.
"I thought we were doing this together on the weekend."
"Daisy might be here by the weekend," I tell him lightly. "They're going to drop her last morphine dose tomorrow and see how she handles it."
"You didn't think to call me. I wanted to help you with this."
Sam is frowning, and I frown too. I didn't think you'd have time."
"I'll make time for these things."
And then, patient Sam disappears in the blink of an eye, and I meet a new Sam, exasperated Sam.
"Jesus, Lexi, I'm getting so frustrated with you cutting me out of this shit. I feel like I'm constantly chasing you down these days."
Sam rarely snaps, but when he does, it packs a punch. I'm speechless for a moment.
"I don't mean to," I whisper. Sam sighs and steps out of the doorway, letting me through into the hall.
When I join him inside, he catches my shoulders in his palms and forces me to stare at him. I'm stinging at his tone, but I don't doubt that he's hurt. I'm sorry, Sam. And then I know I have to say something. I know I have to explain myself better. But all I can offer him is a weak, I just don't know how to deal with this with you.
I don't know what that means, Lexi, Sam says. There's a desperate confusion in his gaze as he looks down at me. Isn't it easier to deal with this with me? If it isn't, something is really wrong between us.
I've just always dealt with this kind of thing on my own.
That's because you've always been on your own. I keep telling you, Lexi, we're a team in all of this, okay? I want to know. I need to know. You haven't even told me how Annie is doing this week.
That's because I don't know. I try to think about when I last updated Sam on Annie's progress. When was the last time I actually had a proper chat with him? Not one in a hallway or as we're drifting off to sleep. A proper sit-down discussion.
I can't remember.
Luke has taken away her phone privileges. She wasn't doing so well.
Sam scowls at me, and his palms on my shoulders release suddenly, so I step back. Now the slightly increased distance between our bodies is starting to feel vast, and I know it's my fault.
I sigh and rub my forehead as he says, "You didn't think to mention that?" Am I supposed to tell you every little thing that happens with her? Neither one of us has time for that. And do you really want to know anyway? It's exhausting keeping up with her drama, trust me.
Sam's face falls, and I feel mine fall right along with it. I have insulted him again, and I didn't mean to.
Doesn't he see that I'm trying to protect him from the stress of it all?
He crosses his arms over his chest. Sometimes, I think you don't know me at all, Lexi.
He said the words quietly, which somehow hurts more than if he'd shouted them. He leaves the room, and I note the downward curve of his shoulders and the way that his head sits low. I'm alone in the hallway now, and I'm frustrated and embarrassed and angry.
Sam has three perfectly intelligent, handsome brothers who never cause any drama and go about their professional careers like normal people.
We know nothing of their day-to-day lives because we don't need to. They're healthy, happy, and just like we are, busy. I've met them a few times, but I'm sure that Sam doesn't update me every time he talks to them. I don't expect him to. So now I'm supposed to give him a status update every single time I hear something about Annie or Daisy? I'd rather shield him from it, as much as I can anyway, and just let him focus on his work and continue to enjoy his life. This is my problem. Annie is my problem. And by extension of that, Daisy is my problem. Yes, she is coming into our home, but that doesn't mean he needs to be burdened by every aspect of this saga. He should be grateful that I'm saving him from the burden.
I rise and start unpacking the car, my movements forceful. I spend the next few hours setting up the spare room as a nursery, and it's only as I go to fall into bed, some hours later, that I realize Sam is in the study. I walk along the hallway and see the light coming from under the door. I raise my hand to knock, to ask if he is going to come to bed. But the light flicks off.
Sam? I call hesitantly.
I just need some space, Lexi. He calls back.
This is a small thing. He's just sleeping two doors down from me. It's not like he's walked out on me. But it's also a huge thing, because this is the first time that Sam has ever opted to sleep away from me. The first time he's ever told me he needs space. Sam loves to cuddle me in the night. It actually took some getting used to at first. It suddenly strikes me how much space we have actually had. In all of the weeks since Annie's late night call, Sam and I have not made love once. I look back now and realize this is not for lack of trying on Sam's part. I have been pulling away.
Maybe I even pulled away in one single and sharp moment the night Annie called. I'm stricken with guilt as I consider this, but the defensiveness remains, and I'm frustrated that Sam does not give me at least a little more leeway. Maybe I actually need him to make himself invisible for a time, while I deal with the magnitude of Annie's situation. This thought is like ice water on my anger. Over the past 2 years, Sam has accepted me as I am, warts and all, and he wants to build a future with me. He adores me. I can see that when he looks at me. And what do I reward him with? I take him for granted, and I automatically begin cutting him out, right when I need him most. I retreat to our bedroom, but I spend hours lying awake, my racing mind working overtime as I try to outrun my guilt. I sleep in the next morning, and Sam is gone by the time I wake up. When I finally arrive at the hospital, I'm immediately taken to the meeting room with Daisy's neonatologist. He tells me that she is doing amazingly well without any morphine, and that provided she remains stable, he's going to prepare her discharge paperwork. "But doesn't she still have some issues?" I blurt. "Are you sure this is safe?" He raises an eyebrow at me, confused, and fair enough, I guess, since he's giving me the best news ever and I'm trying to talk him out of it. "She's obviously still small, and the rigidity in her muscles might take some time to resolve, and you'll need to keep her on the prescription formula. I'd like to see her back here every couple of days, but I really do think it will be good for her to be in a more relaxed home environment now. She is 6 weeks old, you know. It's time." I swallow hard. "Okay, then." I go in to see Daisy and find her lying wide awake, staring up at a mobile someone has moved over her crib. I glance at her chart and see that it's been well over 12 hours since she had any morphine, and she's settled and content. I text Sam. "I'm so sorry. Can you spare me some time today?" I meet Sam in his office just after lunch. He was in surgery this morning, and he already looks tired. I extend a coffee toward him as a peace offering. He takes it, but he doesn't smile. I sit in the patient's chair opposite his large oak desk. Sam initially moves to sit behind the desk, then stops himself and walks back around to sit beside me. I watch as he toys with the lid of the coffee. "I've been dealing with my family's problems on my own for a long time," I say without preamble. "Annie makes a mess, she dumps it on my lap, and I clean it up. I've been doing this with her since she was a kid. And Mom was never really engaged, not after Dad died. I've always had to be the adult, the only adult. But I've had a nice hiatus for the last 2 years, and I wasn't prepared for this, and I certainly haven't been prepared to share the burden. I'm really sorry, Sam. I didn't mean to leave you out. I didn't mean to hurt you." I'm babbling, and Sam's watching me expressionlessly. Is all of this too late? I want so much for him to react and to tell me I haven't ruined what we have. Just when I start to panic, he rests his hand on mine. I feel the warmth of his body radiating through to mine. I have been so terrified since my late night revelation last night. And now, with a single touch, I feel capable, confident, supported, strong. "The thing is, Alexis Vidler, I love you more than anything," he says slowly. "Yes, this is a messy situation, but you need to give Daisy a home now, and I want that to be our home. I don't want it to be your home. I'll do better. I promise." "No, Lexi, I want you to do worse," Sam says gently. "I want you to stumble and let me pick you up. I want you to tell me the load is too heavy and let me carry some of it. I don't want you to superwoman me out of our life."
When I nod, Sam squeezes my hand gently, and at last we share a smile. She hasn't had morphine since last night, I tell him, and his eyes widen.
How is she?
Content.
So, do I need to organize a day off to bring her home with you?
No, I say, and when he frowns at me, I add hastily, I just know how hard it is.